I'm Carol Coletta, and this is Smart City. Cities inspire us in so many ways. For architect Teddy Cruz, the contrast between the sister cities of San Diego and Tijuana have inspired award-winning work that explores border crossings, reuse and adaptation of materials and buildings, and new patterns of mixed-income housing. We'll talk to Teddy Cruz about his work today on Smart City. Jamie Wallace is a Pittsburgh attorney who found a different calling as owner of Abai, an Ethiopian restaurant in the city's East End. It's the first in a series of conversations we'll have with urban entrepreneurs who are changing neighborhoods in America's cities with their passion, their hard work, and their investment. We'll be back for those conversations right after the news. You're listening to Smart City. I'm Carol Coletta. San Diego architect Teddy Cruz and his firm Estudio Teddy Cruz has been working along the Mexican border for years. He won the 2004-2005 James Sterling Prize for Border Postcard, Chronicles from the Edge, a project exploring new urban strategies for the international border zone spanning San Diego and Tijuana. He has designed new mixed-use developments that reuse and adapt existing structures and recycled materials, and has a national reputation for his low-income housing designs. Teddy is an assistant professor of architecture at Woodbury University's San Diego campus. You write, Teddy, that your practice is inspired by your location at the border between San Diego, California, and Tijuana, Mexico. How does location affect your work?
Well, primarily in a time when we have exhausted this reading of globalization that has been the obsession of architectural schools and urban think tanks, I think there is a need now to reorient our gaze and to really understand the particularities of of a region and of the territory, so that by understanding these conditions, really that construct the very specific territory, in this case, in my case, the border region between Tijuana and San Diego, probably some of those issues at the global scale are reflected even more dramatically, and that we can really begin to make sense of, at least through my practice, of these transborder urbanisms, the phenomena that really defines this territory for me as an amazing laboratory. I mean, I keep thinking that no other place in the world you would find in 80 linear miles compressed the most radical and dramatic issues in terms of urbanism, politics of surveillance, labor, sprawl, density, formal and informal economies, wealthy enclaves surrounded by circles of poverty and so on. So yes, the observation of the local, the kind of, I call it the radicalizing of the local, has brought to the discussion a new idea of localism without, romanticizing it, because at some point it also became a cliché. But I think there is a need to really understand the drama of these very specific issues in order to then produce new readings of globalization. So it's not one or the other. It's that the kind of zooming out and the zooming in simultaneously almost would allow us to maybe construct a more effectual or more tactical sort of ways of intervening in the city.
What can you generalize from the intense study of Tijuana and life there?
In this case, again, a very, very specific phenomena, let's say. One example could be to anticipate for a moment that the future of the city, particularly a kind of post-9/11 city, I can say, continues to be defined by the division of the territory between enclaves of mega wealth and the service sectors or the service communities that surround it, the kind of impact of immigration, let's say, in the redefinition of, in this case, the American metropolis or the American neighborhood. So this relationship of proximity, of poverty and wealth in very radical ways is one general kind of condition. The other one is how these two cities, making a territory that is incredibly contested and we could say the busiest, most trafficked border in the world, begins to suggest that these cities repel each other, particularly at this moment, right, where anti-immigration and anti-terrorism have fused into a very discriminatory kind of project against density and so on. that these two cities also juxtapose themselves. I mean, they contain each other. So a very interesting phenomena. For example, let's imagine that entire pieces of San Diego are being dismantled or demolished. Let's say the old bungalows, post-war bungalows, that are being replaced by larger condominium projects or McMansions, are being demolished, and the debris of this is being transferred to Tijuana to build Tijuana's new periphery. So it's an urbanism made of waste that is being transferred southbound into Tijuana. And on the other side, so let's imagine while waste travels south, people go north in search for jobs, in search for dollars, and so the impact of immigration on the other side, let's say in San Diego, begins to tell us that also the many neighborhoods in the American city begin to be transformed by immigrants constructing their own conditions of sustainability. So in a large parcel with one house, now there might be three extra units that at this moment are illegal, but nevertheless make sense in terms of the kind of density that this city can support. And not only that, but the informal economies that are plugged into an otherwise very homogenizing, you know, kind of environment. So I think these transferences, these exchanges, these two-way kind of journeys between one city and another, I think begin to be anticipatory, all right? There are anticipatory scenarios of how other cities are being shaped in the world.
How do you express solutions through your work?
And that's, of course, the most difficult thing for an architect and urbanist, you know, how ultimately to intervene. And I think something that I've been noticing really is that our fields, our creative fields that have to do with the city and the politics and economics of development have not really engaged a critical observation of the issues of the territory. What shapes the territory? What are the processes that shape particular mortgage structures or particular land use issues? And so I cannot intervene before understanding these conditions. So one first issue is the critical reading of the territory, let's say. From that, by understanding how the mid-city in San Diego has transformed out of non-conforming patterns of density, informal economies, by understanding how the waste begins to be recycled as people organize themselves in Tijuana to build an urbanism that, as precarious and poor as it might look, is very rich in social relations. So this begins to create a framework, let's say a conceptual framework for me that can inform a way of constructing a practice. And that practice maybe is first established not by thinking of building first, right? As, you know, the architects are obsessed with form, with tectonics, with, you know, the kind of obsession with the object. In my case, I've begun a practice that suggests that no advances in design can occur without advances in policy and in economic sort of process. So I've been collaborating with, in fact, nonprofit organizations based in neighborhoods, like the ones that I'm saying are transforming in front of our very eyes in San Diego. These agencies are community-based, and they have been social service providers. But now, out of conditions of emergency, they are becoming developers, micro-developers of affordable housing. So the idea is that we as designers could not only design buildings, but we could design process. In other words, by creating collaborations, we can design a very different process that might yield more inclusive land use conditions, in my case, is a searching for a new role for these community-based entities that can act as informal city halls of sorts, that they become partners with the municipality to produce a very different agenda in terms of land use, but also in terms of economic sustainability. This is what we forget as architects, you know, that what really creates this sort of gentrification and these sort of large projects being brought into any downtown in the United States, this large development is backed up by particular mortgage or lending structures, very large construction loans to make these projects feasible and profitable. To rethink the economic framework that is really producing housing in the U.S. is in a primary site of investigation. So that begins to, it's a larger story, but what I'm trying to say is that with this nonprofit organization that I've been working with in San Isidro, a neighborhood next to the border on the U.S. side, The task has been, before designing the housing prototypes that we have designed, we had to design a political and an economic process that could make this project sustainable. Social service in exchange for rent, a sweat equity as being part of a pro forma, the nonprofit becoming a kind of mediating agency to break down a large loan into small microcredits, social organization in relationship to design, and so on. So what I'm trying to say is we can be designers of process that can then yield particular prototypes.
As an architect, how do you get compensated for designing economic and political process?
It's a very precarious, you know, situation. I mean, I don't have to tell you how much money is in my bank account at this moment. It's like really a kind of struggle. But I teach at the Visual Arts Department at UC San Diego, University of California, San Diego, who have created a completely new program based on my presence there called Public Culture and Urbanism. And the idea that research can produce new models. So my practice is a small studio, but it's a hybrid between practice and research-based agency. And so the teaching, of course, supports a lot of our investigations. Now we are trying to form this think tank laboratory out of UCSD and out of my practice to generate and act as a kind of consultancy for these kinds of issues and so on. So research can hopefully bring funding, let's say, that can be mixed with practice. And that's what has been absent from really approaches towards the city. Research is given to science, to technology, but not to ways of rethinking the urban environment. And so that's what we are trying to do right now, to make a case that we need the kind of knowledge that we can produce about these alternative processes can be information that augments the kinds of projects that planning departments in cities do. As a planning director of San Diego once told me, I mean, we barely have budgets to sustain our own programs, and we lack a kind of learning curve in terms of really, you know, rethinking the model. And so hopefully that's what we'll create a sustainable kind of condition for my practice. But in essence, it's a struggle. You know, we need to constantly make a case that, particularly in our culture in the United States, I think, where we believe that only economic value is a seed for development. I think we need to somehow bring back the idea. I mean, Chicago is an example of it. I mean, just seeing the amazing buildings that once were possible. And I think I doubt that now, you know, the way that our economic system is working, this investment in public institution and public infrastructure is not possible, but yet is possible sometimes, like what is happening in Chicago. So what I'm trying to suggest is that we need to continue pushing the idea in terms of governance, in terms of development, in terms of academia, that social and public value can also be a seed, you know, for development. Not only the power of economic, you know, capital, but the power of social capital. And so it's a difficult thing to do, in particular in a time that we are living, where even our administration, you know, it has declared itself an enemy of the kind of social and public program towards the city and public institution. More and more is being eroded. I think it's an important task, I think, to remind all of us, I think, that public infrastructure can frame viable economic, you know, engines. And so that's the reason I've tried to learn a lot more about development, right? To speak the language of developers, to make the case for these things really being economically feasible, not just capricious, you know, dreams of an architect. So somewhere in there, I think hopefully we'll begin to get more support.
You've mentioned density several times. The American dream, at least the traditional version of the American dream, is all about wide open spaces, which most Americans believe is the antithesis of density. Americans are not naturally fans of density. You've been working on that problem. Can it be solved?
Actually, that's a really crucial question. I mean, San Diego is a very specific case of a place that is where people are incredibly afraid of density. And I think we need to first rethink its meaning. I mean, in terms of, I think our effort is not only to intervene in the territory, right, into new modalities of sociability, physical kind of planning, land use, transformations, and so on. But one project, I think, is the publics of, or kind of the debate of public culture, in a way. I mean, what do we mean by density? I mean, if you really think about it, density is measured in a normative way by all our institutions, government, development, academia. Amount of people per acre, it's an abstract kind of equation that we continue to perpetuate. To rethink that as a kind of different agenda. And can we think of density, for example, as an amount of social exchanges per acre, right? as an amount of collaborative kind of efforts per acre, and so on. I mean, neighborhoods that you might come and see, well, this is not that dense. In reality, there are agencies within those neighborhoods that are producing very interesting collaborations across the neighborhoods, or maybe neighbors in one block collaborating to share infrastructure, share spaces, and so on. To bring back the idea that to make a particular our time of a kind of environmental, you know, emergency in a sense, that it is about reconsidering social integration and kind of resources, that the redistribution of resources, the kind of reintegration of housing into a framework of social service or public infrastructure, transportation, and so on, is continues to be part of the conversation. So it's really about a moment of emergency. You know, we need to address the issue that density is not just big buildings, that it is about levels of integrating what has been divided, and then in so doing, not compromising our quality of life. This is the first thing, you know, that is so sacred for San Diegans. But in fact, to suggest that precisely because we have not addressed these issues of density in a different way, we have compromised ultimately our quality of life. Look at what is happening right now as this sprawl in San Diego is crashing against these canyons that continue burning, and so on, this sort of collision between development and the natural, you know, ecology, right, that exists in San Diego. So in essence, is to rethink the meaning. What do we mean by density? What do we mean by housing? For example, housing in Southern California is just a production of maximizing units, spread it through the territory responsibly. It's not about, for example, density. It's about units in relationship to other things. Units in relationship, you know, to social service programs or maybe public infrastructure. But then, yes, who is going to pay for all that? I mean, that's part of the issue, right? And that's where maybe another aspect that is more complicated comes in, which is how we design collaboration. I mean, how do we design smart kind of relationships between private and public entities to produce different ideas of public space, for example?
What are the lessons that can be learned from Mexico and Tijuana?
In general, in a general kind of scale, at a larger kind of global scale, I could say, in a very determined sort of way, that the third world will incrementally teach the first in terms of social sustainability. I'm not talking about green buildings, the whole rhetoric of LEED scores in terms of environmental responsibility. A lot of development that is very responsible, in fact, is being hidden beneath these sort of LEED agendas. Don't misunderstand me, that's all important, this sort of awareness, but I think more needs to be done. And I think that more has to do with understanding that environmental sustainability cannot occur without social sustainability, or the issue, again, of the kind of social and the political, that to transform the kind of stupidity at times of bad planning and the kind of sprawl that is really affecting many of our the edges of our cities, we need to transform policies. We need to transform processes, as I was talking about. That has been occurring in other places in the world, in particular in the third world. Brazil has become an example. For example, Curitiba in the last years has been an incredible model, yet there are not enough documents that transcribe or translate the very complex and at times very inventive process that Jamie Lerner, the ex-mayor of Curitiba, had to construct to build infrastructure with very low means. Bogota, Enrique Peñalosa, and others creating an amazing system of transportation, of taxation, of exchange and collaboration across public and private. In other words, best practices towards the urban, towards the city that have emerged in just places of where social emergency produces these kind of inventive, clever collaborations. So not only Mexico, but the rest of the world, I think, in terms of the Southern Hemisphere, we need to review those environments. We need to see how what they've done there could apply to what we are doing here. I mean, look at it. There is this euphoria towards China right now. All the architects are flocking to China to build their dream castles. They say, well, China is the future. Well, I just went to Shanghai the other day from the airport to the city. Looks like Los Angeles, you know, looks like a car dealer after car dealer. The Pudong area of Shanghai looks like Irvine in steroids. That's how I called it. So it's like they're importing the bad examples of the first world, you know. And so, again, looking for best practices in terms of how communities have reshaped themselves out of reinventing these political, economic, and processes. Now, in the most immediate kind of sort of scale, which is the one that I occupy, San Diego, Tijuana, what to learn from Tijuana. I mean, I many times think that Tijuana is a laboratory for me to observe how to learn from Tijuana, just like maybe Venturi once said, you know, learning from Las Vegas. It has to do, again, with, I think, looking, realizing that not the city is a larger laboratory, but the neighborhood, that the dynamics are the very localized scale of a community have begun to produce experimental sort of procedures that can then be transcribed into the U.S., into the way that sprawl is really growing. So, for example, the study of this, or at least the observation of these shanty towns, right, that a lot of people would dismiss as poor, precarious, dangerous environments. It is there where there is a DNA, possibly, about how these environments interact not only in a more gentle way with the topography, with the environment, but primarily the fact that these are environments are shaped by collaboration, by sharing of resources, by people organizing themselves. In other words, social organization is what precedes urbanism. I keep thinking that translating some of those tactics and strategies that shape these slums or these shanty towns, transcending just their image of as poverty, as precariousness, but to really abstract them into procedures could then allow me as an architect to invent ways of intervening. Okay, but there is an act of translation. It's not to say that the whole place should become a shanty town. It's that there are very interesting conditions, for example, in the way that people, you go to these environments, you don't see property lines. I mean, while there are property lines, so this sort of sharing of boundaries is an urbanism that is really ignited by negotiating limits and boundaries, and that already presents a very different agenda. So that's what I'm trying to say, that a lot has been said throughout the decades about architecture without architects, informal settlements, and all of that. We need to go to a next level, and I think this is of interpretation, and it has to do with a more sophisticated, possibly, way of interpreting this, to then create a very different agenda that can then redefine land use, the kind of discriminating land use that continues to divide communities and jurisdictions in the United States. So that's what I mean, is continuing to flesh out, you know, tactics and strategies. A lot of people say to me, I mean, come on, you're glorifying poverty. You know, you're romanticizing these environments because they look cool. You know, these sort of. Sometimes I say, well, so what? I mean, maybe it's a risk worth taking to enter these environments and really, on one hand, say yes, they are beautiful. Why not? But I want to transcend the image of these environments. That's what I keep saying. Let's not just look at this image. Let's understand what is beneath it. And beneath it, the territory is shaped by a very different agenda. How to dismantle the pieces of that agenda to reconstruct a different idea of policy is where the interest is.
Teddy Cruz is an architect based in San Diego. The latest news in the world of urban planning, design, and development comes to us from Planet as an assistant editor, Nate Berg.
After more than a year of public participation and town hall meetings, the voices and ideas of the people of Philadelphia have gelled into a set of recommendations for redeveloping the city's waterfront along the Delaware River. Aided by the urban design effort Penn Praxis of the University of Pennsylvania, Philadelphia residents were able to communicate their ideas for improving the waterfront, including expanded green spaces, increased public access to the water, and development patterns that emphasize recreation and leisure. But with these ideas has come opposition from the local real estate developers. A recent editorial in the Philadelphia Inquirer takes aim at the claims of these developers, who argue that actually doing what the people have suggested would significantly cut down their ability to keep developing projects as they do now. Exactly the kinds of waterfront developments that people have just finished saying they don't want. Allowing the developers' criticism to overpower the voice of the people, says the author, will only further encourage the type of short-sighted and uninteresting development that has made the city's riverfront as drab and unsuccessful as it is. And in the city where the words drab and unsuccessful are less criticism than fact, officials are trying a new kind of approach for dealing with population decline and property blight. National Public Radio reports that officials in Flint, Michigan are selling off abandoned properties for $1 each and turning the rest into public parks in an effort to help the depopulating city shrink in a way that won't kill it. The need for this approach is pretty dire, as the dozens of abandoned homes in the city are not only driving down the property values of their next-door neighbors, but they're also hurting property values in the other cities in the county. Officials and residents are hoping that the $1 sale will ease the former industrial town's transition from a devastated ghost of a city to a sustainable rural small town. And finally, Seattle, Washington is also looking to undergo a citywide transition in the coming years. City council members recently approved a 10-year bicycle master plan that has the potential to rework the city into a world-class cycling mecca. An article in the Seattle Times reports that the master plan will include 118 miles of new bike lanes, 19 miles of biking trails, and improved signage to make drivers more aware of the roadway's other users. The bicycle master plan is being lauded as one of the country's best examples of a city's encouragement of cycling as a viable transportation option. And though many other big American cities have their own bike plans, Seattle stands apart as being one of the only for which the money needed to implement it has already been approved. For Planetizen, I'm Nate Berg.
Nate Berg is assistant editor for Planetizen.com. After a short break, we'll talk with Jamie Wallace about his small corner of the world in the East End neighborhood of Pittsburgh, where he runs the restaurant Ubai Ethiopian Cuisine. You're listening to Smart City. You're listening to Smart City. I'm Carol Coletta. Jamie Wallace is an attorney who practiced corporate law until he decided to make his mark on Pittsburgh by opening the Ethiopian restaurant Ubai. He was named one of Pittsburgh's 40 Under 40. This is the first in a series of Smart City conversations with urban entrepreneurs changing neighborhoods in America's great cities. What was your inspiration for starting Ubai?
I was an attorney here in town, and I went to law school at the University of Pittsburgh and graduated in 97. And as an associate, was a young professional here in the city, and would get together with my friends and sort of lament the things that Pittsburgh was lacking. Like, we had a lot of friends who, once they graduated law school, went to other cities. And one of the things that we would do is visit our friends and then come back to Pittsburgh and say, oh, well, we're missing this thing or we're missing this thing, and it would be great if Pittsburgh would have, you know, a number of different things. So something that would always come up is sort of the restaurant scene and the entertainment scene. And what was lacking, I felt, and a number of my friends felt, was diversity of the scene. So if you go to D.C., there's a ton of different restaurants you can go to, or New York or L.A., et cetera. And since Pittsburgh's roots are primarily European immigrants, that's really the focus of the restaurants here. There hasn't been an influx of Latinos, for example, or Asians, or Caribbean or Africans like there has been in a number of other cities. So my thought was that it would be great, instead of complaining about this, to actually do something about it and to pick a neighborhood that I thought was going through a bit of a revitalization or had the potential to, and buy a building and get started that way. So that was sort of the impetus behind it. Now, why it would be an Ethiopian restaurant, which was kind of the main question that everyone would have when I had this idea. To step back a bit, when I was an undergrad, I had a number of friends who were from a variety of African countries, and it got me interested in their cultures. And once I was in law school, after my first year of law school, I had the chance to travel and take classes at the University of Nairobi in Kenya, and that sort of cemented my interest even more in the continent. So from that time forward, every single waking moment I had, I would spend sort of reading as much about the continent and befriending as many people as I could, and it kind of carried through. And so here in Pittsburgh, I knew a number of Ethiopians and kind of had the idea and was able to pitch it to them and see what they thought about it and kind of take it from there.
All right, that's how you got to know Africa. How did you get to know the restaurant business?
Before my first year of law school, so in between college and law school, the only restaurant experience I had was working in a startup Indian restaurant. And it was a neat process just to sort of work in a place that was brand new, didn't have any set way of doing anything, and they were kind of figuring it out as they went along. And so really, though, that was other than eating in restaurants like most Americans, that the only exposure I had was that summer before law school. So before I did this, obviously, in putting together the business plan, part of what I did as much as possible is read as many books as I can on the industry and then also just tap into the resources that I had. I knew some people who were chefs or owned restaurants, so I was able to visit their places and try to figure out how to do this thing. But obviously, I mean, as much as I put into planning and you try and think of every possible thing that could go wrong, it's still every bit as challenging as I thought it would be.
So you said you chose a neighborhood, East End, which you felt was undergoing revitalization or had the potential to do that. What were the markers for you, Jamie, that said this is a neighborhood with potential?
Yeah. I was fortunate enough to be in that neighborhood more than most people. And here's an interesting thing about where we're located. We're located, like you said, in the East End, sort of on the border of East Liberty and Shadyside. Shadyside kind of is viewed as, I guess for lack of a better word, sort of a yuppie neighborhood. And East Liberty is viewed as a traditionally black neighborhood. And so, and to go further back in history, East Liberty wasn't always an African American neighborhood. In the 60s, it went through sort of an urban renewal, and the URA had a plan that kind of didn't work out, and there were a number of people got shifted from Homewood, which was also a traditionally black neighborhood, to East Liberty. The neighborhood itself ended up becoming blighted for a number of reasons, and was that way until very recently. So, but fortunately, I knew some people who were starting to do some things in the neighborhood, despite the fact that it kind of still had a reputation of maybe a little bit dangerous and dicey. But there were some people that I knew, and I could go there and look around and say, wow, this is a great place. The location's perfect. There's old architecture here that can be rehabbed and be really beautiful. There were some other kind of major players who were looking at the neighborhood. A Home Depot came in at some point, and then a huge thing that transpired was Whole Foods coming in and into the East Liberty. And then it started to get people to kind of go to the neighborhood more because, again, they had to overcome the perspective of, this is the neighborhood that I heard on the news where some crime took place. And it was interesting for me because when I was saying, yeah, here's what I'm going to do. I'm going to leave my job. And number one, I'm going to open an Ethiopian restaurant. Everyone's like, oh, that's crazy. Where are you going to do it? And I'm like, oh, in East Liberty. Like, that's a terrible idea. You're going to close in 2 months. But I felt like there was enough happening And there was a ton of stuff that was going to happen. And if I could be one more person to get a business in there that would be a good business that would draw people, then it would just kind of continue to grow and hopefully have a snowball effect.
I want to ask you a question, and it's sort of a tough one, but were you motivated by profit? Were you motivated by revitalizing the neighborhood? Were you motivated by owning a restaurant or sharing a culture with other Pittsburghers? What was the real motivation, and where did profit fit into that motivation?
Well, I thought that definitely not motivated by profits, because I thought that I could make more money as a lawyer than I would make as a restaurant owner. Like, I knew enough to know that profit margins were narrow, and there are tons of ways to do it wrong and only a few ways to do it right. My main motivation was from a cultural standpoint. I really thought that having this type of restaurant would just add to the city. It would be one more thing we could check off. Again, when I think back to my friends saying, we don't have this, we don't have that, just one more thing where we can say, yeah, we do have this type of restaurant. And even though it's small, it's a reflection of the city and how it's more progressive. Secondly, just as important, for me to be in a neighborhood, to be able to buy the building, to be able to renovate this building and watch, be a part of this process and watch this grow. And to be, and to be proud to say, yeah, that's where we're located. Whatever you might have thought, however many years ago it was a certain way, it's changing and we're moving forward. And so it was really twofold from my standpoint.
What were the biggest hurdles to getting started?
As everyone says, financially, it was a pretty sizable investment, because what I bought was an old building that essentially needed to be gutted. So I looked at it as sort of buying a location with walls and a roof, and that was about it. So obviously financially there are just always obstacles, but sort of from a bureaucratic standpoint, I was astonished at how challenging it was just to open a restaurant that was going to seat 65 or 70 people in the city. And I thought, going through the process, I don't know how a person does this who's not a lawyer and who doesn't have the ability to navigate all there is. I mean, there will be instances where, just for example, from an inspection standpoint, you have to have both the city look at something and the county look at something. So in the same day, we might have the city inspector come by and say that we should make whatever change, and then have the county inspector come by and say, why would you make that change? That doesn't make any sense. And we would say, well, we're trying to comply with what the city is asking us to do. And the county would say, no, it has to be this way. Little things like that, just from a bureaucratic standpoint, were very frustrating and kind of slows down the pace of an opening. And you're constantly kind of navigating the bureaucratic obstacles that are there, which is frustrating. And I felt like just getting open was a success. And I've watched sort of other people go through this process, and I empathize with them, because you want to get open, you want to get the registers ringing, and you know that every day you're not open, being behind schedule, it hurts you monetarily, obviously. And it's just, that was a very frustrating process for me, because I wanted to streamline everything as quickly as possible and get moving. And I feel like that's one of the things that I'm hopefully have the opportunity to speak out about in the city, because what we're trying to do in Pittsburgh is attract business, retain people, stop sort of the flow of people leaving the city. And to obviously to attract businesses, we have to make it business friendly. And there are some issues that we need to deal with to make it better than we have it right now.
And if you were advising urban leaders on how to make it easier and quicker to open a business, what would you tell them?
I think that the coordination needs to be better between the entities that are involved. So for us, because it's a restaurant and you're going to have gas and potential fires and a number of hazards that could take place, as opposed to, say, just a retail store, there are more ordinances in place, and you do have a variety of inspectors coming through. And I think it all needs to be coordinated more how a business would coordinate something, as opposed to how a number of different government entities would. The communication between the entities, it could be better, and it just could be streamlined in a much more efficient manner.
Does that mean perhaps having a team leader, customer service rep, as assigned to you so that you have one person who then communicates and travels with the team, having inspections all at once? What can you imagine they could do?
That's actually a great idea. And what I wondered when I was going through this process is how other cities have done this that who have been successful. But what you just mentioned is a great idea. I mean, having a sort of a contact person that maybe is assigned to you that can focus on what you're doing, and at least you know who to call to get something done. I mean, part of the challenge is figuring out all the different entities that you have to get involved in the process. Mm-hmm. And again, you're to the point where you're ready to open, and it's kind of like the last slew of final inspections needs to get done, and just to coordinate that could delay you a month at times.
How did you finance the business? You said you actually bought a building, you had to rehab the building, then of course you had to have working capital, or additional capital, I suppose, to buy restaurant equipment, et cetera, and then on top of that, you've got to have working capital. How did you put the money together?
Yeah, I financed it creatively. Luckily, because I had worked sort of a normal job before doing this crazy venture, I was able to save up a little bit of money through working, and fortunately had good credit, so I was able to actually get bank financing for the project. But even that was great, and I was very fortunate to sort of have a contact who was a banker who did wonders for me, because he was able to get on board and he was able to kind of know the neighborhood that I was in, had an understanding of what I was trying to do. So instead of having a reaction of, this is not a good idea, this is a risky venture, Pittsburgh's not ready for something like this, the neighborhood's not ready for something like this, he saw the potential and was able to really push it through. And without that, it would have been really challenging, because banks especially are risk averse, and they're definitely, a restaurant in general is something that they don't like to finance, and then especially in a neighborhood they're not sure about, and especially a concept they're not sure about. So, but yeah, it was primarily bank financing and whatever funds I had.
You opened when?
It was June 2004.
June 2004, and you have how many square feet?
2,200.
All right, 13, well, let's see, what, 3 years later, and 3.5 years later, I guess. How's the business doing?
Good. It's gotten busier each year, so it's great. And part of that is just us being established and more people knowing us, and part of it is what's going on in the neighborhood. So I think more and more, instead of just being a destination location, like I was fortunate enough to be the only one in the city, so there are Pittsburghers who've traveled a lot and might have lived in other cities or even lived in Ethiopia, and were very happy that an Ethiopian restaurant was opening. They would kind of, I would put updates on the internet, on our website, even way before we were opening, just kind of saying, hey, we're coming and here's what's going on and here's what stage we're in. And so they were able to track that, and on opening day, we were just absolutely slammed, people, lines outside, so it was very refreshing. But we were still a destination location, so people came to the restaurant and left the neighborhood. They didn't just happen to be in the neighborhood and then stop in and say, oh, there's an Ethiopian restaurant here. I feel like now what's happening more and more, as there is development in our part of town, there are more people who actually might be in the neighborhood for some other thing. Maybe they're shopping, maybe they're at an event, at a coffee shop, whatever it may be, and they stop in and eat. So in that sense it's been great, and I anticipate that trend will continue.
Have there been surprises for you beyond the difficulty of the process of getting open? You said you were astonished at how tedious it was. Are there other surprises that you've had, either from the running the business or the way in which your customers have responded to it?
Oh, every day. I mean, many of my lawyer friends who still do the same thing that they were doing, I mean, they're curious, because everyone kind of has their own dream or their own business in mind that they might want to do, and they'll always ask me what it's like. And what I say is that, yeah, every single day, like, it's both, it's miserable and fun and exciting. And, I mean, it's everything all in one. And so I could be like, it makes someone manic, I think. You know, I can be extremely excited one minute and very frustrated the next. But from, yeah, I mean, there are tons of things that you can't anticipate. What I have become is sort of a jack of all trades more than I ever thought I would be. So you're dealing with so much equipment that you kind of have to figure things out on your own. So if something goes down in the middle of a busy Saturday night, you better get a screwdriver and start looking at it and trying to fix it. You're just constantly so immersed in what's going on. And I think for us, what I try to do with the business from my standpoint is I knew this was going to be a restaurant, obviously, but my mindset wasn't this has to run like every other restaurant I've read about or been in. My perspective was whether this was a technology company, a robotics company, there are certain principles that I want to apply to my business. So if you come in and you work here, the philosophy that we have, the approach we take, it's the same. I mean, essentially, it's a customer service business. We're promoting culture as much as anything. We want people to have a great time. But there's a component to what I'm trying to do that would be the same regardless. And so I feel like from a customer standpoint, I think they generally get that. Like, they get that what we're there to do isn't just to turn a profit. It's for them to learn and for them to absorb this culture and have an enjoyable time and have it be educational and touch them in a way that's different. And so hopefully they get that.
And just one other question, Jamie. As you think about the restaurant, obviously it has had an effect on the neighborhood. It can't help but have an effect on the neighborhood. Are there things beyond owning and running the restaurant in a good way, in a professional way, that you feel you've done to change the neighborhood?
Well, yeah, I think that what I've been able to do is be involved with some of the different entities that are focused on just neighborhood development, not only in East Liberty or the East End, but in the city in general. So it's interesting because had I not done this, I would not have met with people from East Liberty Development, Inc., or the Urban Redevelopment Authority, or the City of Pittsburgh. And so what I've been able to do is actually get more involved in some of the planning of the direction of the city, and not necessarily that I'm a decision maker, but sort of more in the loop and having these people bounce ideas off me and get my input. And I never would have had that, even though I could have stayed a lawyer and worked at a big firm or worked at a Fortune 50 company and kept doing that. I wouldn't have had the same impact that I could potentially have on the city. And it's really funny, just from opening an Ethiopian restaurant in the East End, that I would then potentially have those opportunities. But yeah, absolutely.
Jamie Wallace is the owner of Abai in Pittsburgh's East End neighborhood. You're listening to Smart City. I'm Carol Coletta. This week's City View's commentator Walker Smith stresses the importance of paying it forward.
I had dinner the other night with the very first person I hired in the Atlanta office when I opened it up nearly 17 years ago. Mark has done very well. He was a year out of college when he joined me as an entry-level associate. Today, he is the biggest deal maker at a major private equity firm in New York. His accomplishments dwarf mine, yet I couldn't be happier for him. Eventually, everyone has this experience of watching people we have mentored or raised mature into bigger successes. It can be a little disconcerting, not because we are jealous of what they have done or become, but because it is a sharp reminder of our own mortality. Mark is now the same age I was when I first hired him. When I am with him, I see someone who is much more commanding and assured than the person I hired many years ago. In fact, he's just as bossy, impatient, and harried as I was at that age. My edge has softened a bit since then, something I see most clearly when I am around Mark. But I don't mean to be morose about this. There is everything to celebrate about Mark's maturation and success. It is incredibly heartening to see what he has done. After all, advancing achievement is exactly what we hope for. We want the next generation to do better and to have more. We want the arc of progress to be ever upward. We want our achievements to pave the way for those who follow to achieve even more. Of course, this is easy to say in the abstract. When you're face to face with it, it's harder to accept. You see you're getting old, and you wonder if the best you'll ever be able to do is already behind you. But that doesn't mean that it's bad. It just means that the best thing we have done for ourselves is what we have done to help the next generation do even better. Our contribution to this kind of steady generational progress is found as much in what we leave undone as in what we do. We must create something to give, but we must leave something yet to be created as well. Those who will follow us in the next generation not only need what we have made and built, they need untapped, untainted resources and opportunities too. I worry that in our zeal to make the most of things for ourselves, we are leaving too little for the next generation to have much of anything at all. We needed a clean environment. They will too. We needed an abundance of natural resources. They will too. We needed a shared, compassionate commitment to the well-being of all. They will too. I see in my friend Mark the genius that the future always holds. I'm just glad I didn't mess it up when I had responsibility for helping and nurturing it. Now what I say to Mark is that he owes the same to the generation behind him. And it's not just Mark. It's each and every one of us, too. For City Views, this is Walker Smith.
Walker Smith is president of Yankelovich. He comes to us from Georgia Public Radio in Atlanta, and his new book is Generation Ageless. Join us online at smartcityradio.com to listen to archive shows, sign up for podcasts, and register for our weekly newsletter. Smart Cities web content and audio archive are supported by CEOs for Cities. National distribution is made possible by the Hyde Family Foundations, investing in programs that generate lasting change to improve the future of Memphis, Tennessee and its citizens. For more information, visit hydefoundations.org. Eric Rudd is our co-producer and engineer. I'm Carol Coletta.